Hello, glowing mamas. You are all in for a treat today, as I have with me someone who is going to inspire, inform, and empower you all. Hannah Wilsmore is with us. Now, Hannah is a midwife in private practice and award-winning childbirth educator based in Adelaide, South Australia. With her background working as a midwife in multiple hospitals over the past 6 years, she knows the ins and outs of the maternity system here in Australia and is passionate about helping women to achieve a positive pregnancy, birth, and postnatal experience. She has completed further study, including becoming a certified Hypnobirthing Australia practitioner, graduating as a Beautiful You Coaching Academy life coach, and completing postgraduate midwifery studies in prescribing, screening, and diagnostics, which allows her to prescribe medications and order ultrasounds and blood tests where necessary. She has a passion for education and holistic evidence-based care and strives to support women to thrive, not merely survive, in their new mum role. She currently offers a variety of midwifery services, including postnatal in-home care packages and Hypnobirthing Australia courses, as well as video and phone consults for women that aren't in South Australia. Now, when Hannah and I first met, we'd actually been following each other online for quite some time. So I knew she was someone that I wanted to be around and pick her brains. And when we eventually did catch up, we could really have stayed and chatted all day. We were so aligned, and we are so aligned, and really share the same passion to empower mums and mums to be. So I'm super excited for us to have this official recorded chat. And I know you glowing mamas are going to love the information she brings to the table. So welcome, Hannah. It's lovely to have you here. And
yeah, thank you for having me.
I really want to kick off with what inspired you to become a midwife and to teach the holistic practices such as hypnobirthing.
Well, really, for as long as I can remember, I wanted to work with babies, and I wasn't sure whether or not to sort of go into nursing or midwifery. But when I was 15, I was really lucky to be able to do work experience in a private hospital in Adelaide, and I was there for a cesarean birth when a baby was born, which was pretty cool, especially at such a young age, absolutely, looking back now. And so that really sort of set me on this path of what I wanted to do. And from there, I just started my degree when I was 18, finished my training, and I've been working as a fully qualified midwife for about 6 years now. And I've worked in a variety of different hospitals and areas of care. And I really do love this job and this profession. I can't imagine doing anything else really with my life. And really, the hypnobirthing side of things and the holistic midwifery care, I probably started out my career as a sort of working quite a medical system, and really felt like there was more that we could be doing for women and better ways that we could be supporting them. And I was lucky enough to look after two women who had used hypnobirthing for their births within about the space of a week, and that really shifted my perspective on hypnobirthing. Before that, I sort of thought it was this hippie thing that maybe seemed a bit too good to be true, and I didn't know much about it. I honestly didn't really know anything about hypnobirthing, and both of these couples just had amazing births, and they were quite different births. You know, they weren't sort of the perfect birth experience, but just how they worked together as a team and how relaxed the women were. And they seemed really confident in their choices and had tools and techniques that they knew could work for them and help them during their labour. And so I thought, okay, there's definitely something in this. And went into hypnobirthing, went to Sydney to do my practitioner training. And I've been teaching for about the past 4 years now.
Amazing. And thankfully you did, because it's such a powerful course, and we'll chat more on that in later questions. So let's create a little bit of a scenario. So a woman has recently conceived and she's looking into her birthing options. Now, at this stage, I really feel like women only realise there's two: a private option through an obstetrician, and B, the public system. So can you please take us through all of the options available, and what do you feel the benefits are for the birthing couple to have a private midwife?
Yeah, definitely. This is an area that I'm really passionate about because, similar to you, I'd found lots of clients that I was working with were just not aware of the different options that there were and sort of all the pros and cons and how they all fit together. And I don't think there is a perfect option for everybody. Mm-hmm. I think it's just about looking into all of your options and deciding what the best caregiver or the most supportive caregiver is going to be for you for the experience that you're wanting for your pregnancy and birth. Mm-hmm. So if we go through, there are quite a few different options. So I'll go over each of them briefly and pros and cons. So if we sort of start with the public system, so we have the mainstream, what I call mainstream public care or clinics, where a woman will go to the hospital, usually the hospital, sometimes a sort of outreach clinic in one of the suburbs, but usually the main tertiary hospital for their appointments. Mm-hmm. They might see different doctors or they might see different midwives depending on the way that their pregnancy is progressing. Then when they come in labour to the hospital, they are cared for on a labour ward. Again, cares by midwives and doctors if needed. And then after their baby's born, they're transferred to a postnatal ward and then discharged home, usually within a day or two of birth. Mm-hmm. And this system is what we call fragmented care. So women often will see lots of different midwives or different doctors, and particularly the midwife that's caring for them in labour is not likely to be one that is known to them. Mm-hmm. So that is, I guess, one of the drawbacks of this system. There's lots of good quality research around continuity of care in pregnancy, and particularly continuity of midwifery care, which means knowing your midwife, building that relationship before your labour and birth so that you know the person that's caring for you in labour and afterwards. There's lots of research that that's really beneficial for women and babies, not only on how they perceive their birth experience and their satisfaction with their birth experience, but also their health and their baby's health. Okay. So this sort of continuity of care is something that we do strive for if we can achieve that. Mm-hmm. So in the public hospitals, we also have the option of caseload midwifery or midwifery group practice, or sometimes it gets shortened to MGP. Yeah. And this is offered through most of our big tertiary hospitals. And this is where women are allocated a primary midwife, and they do all their appointments. They're on call then for their birth, and then they provide care up to four to 6 weeks after their baby is born. Often the appointments are done at home, and this program really does aim to achieve that continuity of care.
And I can absolutely, hands down, say it's the, yeah, we went through the midwifery group practice here in Adelaide, mm-hmm. and yeah, really loved knowing who we were having, or one or two, like we'd met all of them, the options, and yeah, it was a beautiful experience.
And it's not always, you know, we can't guarantee that it will be that primary midwife, but the aim is that hopefully you've met the backup who works with that midwife, or like the aim is that, you know, you will hopefully know either one of your primary midwife or the backup midwife for your birth. And even the continuity, like going forward after your baby's born, and that follow-up after birth in home is really, really beneficial.
Very valuable.
With the midwifery group practice programs, most of them, I think all, depending on where women are in Australia, it differs a little bit, but a lot of them do offer a publicly funded home birth program as well for low-risk women. So that's an option as well.
Sure.
Then we also have birth centre care. So this is, in some states, it's quite popular. In South Australia, where we are, it's a little bit less. We only have one birth centre. And this is a team midwifery approach. So women are accepted sort of into this program, and they have their appointments by a group of midwives. And then when they arrive at the hospital in labour, hopefully one of those midwives from their team is rostered on and is able to care for them. So it's again, trying to get that continuity. But also they have a very holistic approach. Their rooms that they have often have double beds and baths available, similar to the midwifery group practice rooms as well. So that's another sort of lesser known option, but another really good option. One of the big drawbacks with the midwifery group practice programs is that they do book out quite early often. They have capacities, and unfortunately a lot of women do miss out on that program. So the birth centre can sometimes be another option to help fill that gap.
Sure.
And then we have GP shared care as well. So this is through the public system usually, although it can be done privately as well, where a woman will see her GP for her pregnancy appointments and also after her baby's born, and then she will go to the hospital to give birth. This isn't a bad option as such. You know, the woman does, you know, she's built that relationship with her GP potentially over quite a few years. So there is that continuity of care, but the GP isn't there for the birth. And isn't there to provide that labour support. So when I'm working with couples who particularly are hoping to achieve that continuity of care, GP shared care is sometimes not the ideal option for them. And then from there, in the private system, we have private obstetricians and also private midwives. And I think a lot of women know about private obstetricians, but not so much about private midwives. For women choosing a private obstetrician, they will do their appointments during pregnancy, and then the woman will either give birth in a private hospital or a public hospital. So that is another option, that women can have private obstetrician care in a public hospital. And the again, we've sort of got that continuity of care, but the reality is that there will be a midwife caring for these women in labour, and the women won't know that midwife. A little bit fragmented again. It's not quite the continuity that we're aiming for. And then private midwives. So each private midwife works a little bit differently, but there are some private midwives like myself, I really aim to fill the gaps in the system. So I work a lot with women after their baby's born, because I feel like that's a real period where our system's lacking in support. But quite a few of our other private midwives will provide that full continuity of care. So they'll do all the appointments with a mum and her partner during pregnancy. They're then on call for the birth, either for a home birth or a hospital birth as well. And then they provide that care afterwards up until 6 weeks. So it's similar to the midwifery group practice, but it's a private model. And the midwives are, I guess, essentially working for the woman. They're not bound by specific hospital policies so much. And it's often their sort of philosophy, and for women that are choosing a private midwife, they often really gel with that midwife, and they know that they're going to have them there, and they build that relationship and that trust.
Exactly, knowing who's going to be there at the birth. I think that takes away a lot of the, I don't want to say the word fear, but you know, comfort in knowing that they know who's going to be around and have built that trust and rapport with them. So yeah. And so that is obviously what you do as a private midwife. So that's incredible. And I've seen that you've got quite a few different options for post-birth and different programs available, which is really wonderful, because I'm really passionate about that fourth trimester, having that support there, like you said.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for that rundown. That was really good. Because I don't feel that information is out there, as crazy as that sounds.
No, and there's, you know, there are some things, like we know that in private hospitals we do have high rates of cesareans and instrumental births or forceps or Bontoose and epidural use. So you know, this is not just sort of my opinion as a midwife. I really aim to provide unbiased information. But sometimes women, they might really want a water birth or to use a bath for labour. And if they're going to a particular hospital that doesn't have that, and unfortunately quite a lot of our private hospitals don't have any baths, then that maybe is not going to be the most supportive option for them.
Okay, well, when it came to routine testing throughout my pregnancy, we everything that came up, we asked ourselves, how does this benefit me and my baby? What are the risks involved? And after that, then we decided to opt in or out of that particular procedure or test. And there are a few that I left out of our pregnancy journey. So some scans, the glucose tolerance test and the strep test. So I'd love for you today to just go into the latter two for us. So starting with the glucose tolerance test, do you, what really is the purpose of drinking that whopping dose of glucose all at once? And do you feel that there would be some more effective ways of doing that instead?
So the purpose is really to detect women whose bodies may be showing signs of insulin resistance or an inability to get their blood glucose levels back to a normal range after eating. And we know that for women when they're pregnant, there is this sort of degree of insulin resistance, but some women will have that more than others. And unfortunately, some women who do have, you know, completely low risk pregnancy, no, you know, risk factors for gestational diabetes, sometimes they will still go on to develop this. So it's a really, it's a tricky one. What the testing does is assessing how your body responds to a glucose load. And like you said, it is a big amount. I think from memory, it's about 18 teaspoons of sugar. So it's you know, it is a huge whopping amount of sugar. And for, you know, some women, that's not reflective of their everyday diet. Sometimes women will say to me, I would never have that much sugar in one here, or potentially even in a day for a lot of women. So the idea of drinking that in one big consumption for a lot of women is just doesn't fit well with what how they approach their everyday sort of life and lifestyle and diet.
So would there be some other ways of getting around that if they didn't want to do that test?
So like you said, with any testing in pregnancy, it is optional. You know, there's pros and cons to everything, and it's up to an individual couple to make and a woman to make the decision that's right for them. So there's a couple of different options. If we look at the research, it's relatively sort of inconclusive as to what the best screening tool is. So if we look at a Cochrane review, they've said that we need further studies to assess, you know, how we can more accurately test for gestational diabetes. So there's been a few alternatives put forward, but at this point there's not, you know, sort of a definitive answer. So fasting blood sugar testing is one option, and according to some research, definitely has some potential. So they're looking at using a fasting blood sugar test as essentially a screening tool. And so for women that have the normal fasting range, they are looking at treating them as normal glucose tolerance. And then for women that have an elevated reading, potentially going down the path of further testing. Another option that someone will go for is monitoring their own blood sugar levels throughout the day. So this is what a woman who has received a gestational diabetes diagnosis would be recommended to do anyway. So this is where often where women will monitor the blood sugar levels around four times a day for anywhere between 2 to 4 weeks usually. And as far as I know, there's no studies comparing this with the effectiveness of the glucose drink, but anecdotally, I'm hearing quite a few women who are doing this because they're not keen to have the drink and they're looking for other options.
Which is what why I decided to opt out of the glucose tolerance test. And I just felt like that week of having my usual diet and doing those tests was, more accurate, as indicative of what I would usually be loading my body with and how it's responding to my usual diet. So, yeah, that was my decision. And that's it's good to know that you have the option there, which, once again, I don't think women realise they have they can say no to some certain tests.
Exactly. And, you know, again, there's different options that are right for, you know, everybody. So it's just about knowing that you do have choices, and it's not that you have to have every test that's presented to you. It's about working with your caregivers and like you said, asking if it's the right choice for you.
Now, the strep test, I know we've chatted about this before, and I know that you're up to date with the research. So can you just break it down and explain what the test is, when it would be beneficial for a pregnant woman to have, and what stage of their pregnancy they're supposed to be having this, and why one may consider opting out of it? If they do opt out, what does that mean at birth?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the group B strep or GBS bacteria is a bacteria that is often colonized in the gastrointestinal parts of our body, and it's in approximately 20% of pregnant women. So what a lot of our maternity systems will offer is a group B strep vaginal swab at around 36 weeks into mm-hmm. pregnancy. And this will either return a positive result to that bacteria, which is where sort of, you know, around 10 to 30% of women will have that positive result, or it'll return a negative result. And it's not an infection or anything like that, but it is a bacteria that babies can pick up as they're mm-hmm. being born.
Yeah.
So it usually causes no harm. We know that for the majority of babies that are colonized with this group B strep bacteria, they do not develop an infection, mm-hmm. but about 3% will develop this early onset infection. Okay. So I think it's quite a hot topic. Mm-hmm. A lot of care providers disagree, even around Australia. So in South Australia, we currently offer universal screening, which means that we offer it to all women at 36 weeks, but I know that some other states don't, the UK doesn't, and I don't think New Zealand does either. Mm-hmm. So they approach it as risk-based assessments. So they will offer the testing for women who have had a previous baby who was sick with the group B strep. I think if their baby's premature, things like that as well, because we can't sort of say all babies are at the same risk profile of contracting the group strep. And the reality is that most of the babies, a portion are going to become colonized, but very few are going to become sick from the bacteria.
And if it is positive at that 36 weeks, or you have the levels showing up, is there any research on how quickly that can change? Because obviously most women are not going to be having their babies straight away. There any information on that?
That's one of the big drawbacks of our testing at the moment, mm-hmm. is that this is a transient bacteria. So a woman mm-hmm. could test about 36 weeks and actually be positive at the time that she gives birth, or the other way around. So one of the recent articles that was published in, I think it was the British Medical Journal, mm-hmm. They said that there's really a lack of high quality evidence to quantify whether this universal screening is actually having any benefit. And particularly for where this study was published, it's in an area where, or a country where they don't routinely screen for group B strep. And that article is actually titled Universal Antenatal Screening for Group B Strep May Be Causing More Harm Than Good.
Wow. So if it is showing up positive at that 36 week mark, or 37, whenever it is, what happens in birth? Does that mean immediate antibiotics? Or
yeah, so that is the recommendation for a woman that does have that positive result. If it was at 36 weeks, whether they go into labour at 37 weeks or 41 or 42 weeks, they would be recommended to have intravenous antibiotics during labour.
Okay.
And so with what we know about the microbiome for mums and babies, that's going to affect not only that sort of, I guess, bad bacteria, but also their good bacteria as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. And if they, if they opt out of it, then what happens? So are they more closely monitored, or what happens there?
Yeah, it depends on there's lots of differences between the different states. For here in South Australia, generally if you opt out of the test, we treat you as negative, unless there are signs that either you or your baby are developing an infection, of course, and then we can respond to that. But if you opt out for the test, we would treat you as negative, whereas I know in some other states, if women opt out of the test, they're then recommended to have the antibiotics anyway. So they're sort of treated as positive. Okay.
Sure.
So it's really dependent on where you live, which, you know, seems crazy that we don't have a concrete answer on this, but I think that's mm-hmm. relevant to so many things in pregnancy and maternity care. There's still so much that we don't know. It takes a long time for research to filter down into clinical practice as well, a lot of the time. And this is why it's really important for women to look at the benefits, the pros and cons for them, because everybody's different. And we, like I said, we often don't have these concrete answers on things. And even between midwives and doctors, a lot of them are divided on where what they recommend for the group B strep testing as well.
Yeah, that's right. And what I have actually found in chatting to patients and just friends that have did not wanted to have this test, but not confident enough to say no, so pretending they've done the test and therefore not swabbing anything, so it's negative, but they haven't actually done it. I have the opinion that you should at least be honest with your caregiver so they know that you haven't done it. And I think I'm a bit passionate about that. Like, I absolutely, if you don't want to do it, but tell them that you haven't done it.
Yeah, exactly. And because they might be, we're always going to respond to what's happening, you know, in labour anyway.
Yeah.
If there were signs of infection or something like that. But I think, you know, it's really unfortunate that women feel that pressure as care providers. We're there to give women the information and to support them to make that decision, but it's their decision at the end of the day. And I think that's really our system failing if women are feeling like they need to sort of pretend that they've done it because they're feeling so much pressure.
Yeah, and I see it all the time. That actually was my next question I was going to ask. I see a lot of patients and mums that lack that confidence to really express their wishes when it comes to opting in or out of certain test procedures or anything along their pregnancy journey. So do you have any tips as a midwife for building expecting mama's confidence when it comes to chatting to their caregivers and their loved ones, even about their choices throughout their pregnancy, birth and fourth trimester?
I think knowing it is your body and it's your baby, and you're going to make a lot of decisions over, you know, the time when your baby's growing up, and, you know, when they're a toddler and when they're older, and you're the one that knows your body and your baby the best. And like I said before, there's still so much that we don't know. We don't have all the answers medically, and it is absolutely that woman's choice at the end of the day.
Yeah.
One thing that I find helpful is if women are feeling pressured sort of for maybe towards an intervention or something like that, is to really ask their caregivers for the evidence and the statistics to back up sort of what they're saying or where they found that information, so that they can read more and make that informed decision. Because I think sometimes we'll say things like, with the group B strep, you know, babies can get really sick from this, you know, and that's absolutely true. That is a fact.
Yeah.
But it's up to the woman to, you know, be able to look at, you know, is it, you know, a 3% chance? Is it a 10% chance? Is it an 80% chance? And that's the decision for a woman to make, not us to decide what's, you know, seemed as too risky for her. But I think sometimes we as care providers take that on a little bit too much, and we don't provide the exact numbers. So I think for women asking that that question, asking for the pros and cons of what they're suggesting, but also of waiting. So say, for example, with an induction, if a caregiver is recommending that, a woman could ask, okay, what's the pros and cons of having labour induced, but what's also the pros and cons of waiting?
Yes.
As well.
I love that you said that, yeah.
Because I think it's really important, and there is pros and cons to, you know, each situation. Like I said, there's still lots we don't know about labour and birth. And the other thing I would recommend is completing a childbirth education course, like the Hypnobirthing Australia course that I teach, as it really arms you and your partner with a lot of knowledge and confidence. And I have a big focus in my classes on teaching partners ways that they can advocate and questions that they can ask and things like that.
Yeah, amazing. So let's chat about birth. What are the biggest misconceptions that you hear when it comes to bringing bubbas into the world?
Okay, so there's three main ones that I've sort of drilled down to, I think. So one is that you will receive better or safer care with a private obstetrician. Midwives and obstetricians are trained quite differently. Obstetricians are really trained to be the experts in complications and, you know, when there's medical need and emergencies during labour. And they're great at that. You know, that's what they're trained to do. Whereas women who are really wanting a low intervention birth or as natural birth, a physiological birth as possible, the research really supports that they are more likely to achieve that when they're in midwifery-led care versus obstetric-led care. Mm-hmm. And like I said before, I'm not against obstetricians, but I think they're very good at managing what they're trained to do. But the reality is indicating that and so much research is indicating that midwifery continuity of care leads to those better outcomes for mums and babies. And there's a really good quote from Hannah Darlin, and she talks about how you wouldn't hire a pediatric neurosurgeon to babysit your child just in case they had an accident and hit their head, because they're not the best person to do the job.
That's right. Yeah.
And also the chances of that emergency happening are minimal. So I think I quite like that quote, because I think it does put it into perspective. And absolutely, for some women, their care is going to be best placed with an obstetrician, depending on what's happening and what they want from their experience, but it's not going to be the case for all women.
Yeah.
The next misconception that I hear a lot is that home birth is unsafe or only for hippies. You know, you might have heard things like this as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But I've actually had quite a few midwifery colleagues who I've worked with in the hospitals who've then chosen to have a home birth for their baby, even though they work in this hospital system. And there's some really good research showing that home birth is as safe as in hospital birth for women who are having a low risk or healthy pregnancy.
Yeah.
And even before, there was a study showing that women who had a home birth and their babies did just as well as women and babies in the hospital if they were categorised as low risk. Yeah. I think in Australia, our rates of planned home birth are quite low, but if we look at countries like the Netherlands, where 20% of women are planning a home birth, and that's so normal, and it's an integral part of their maternity system as well. Yeah. And there's lots of benefits to birthing at home. There's low rates of interventions, low rates of perineal trauma or pelvic floor damage during birth, cesarean rates, things like that as well. And women who have a home birth also have higher rates of satisfaction related to their home being a more comfortable environment and feeling more in control of their experience.
Absolutely. So we, as I've chatted about with you, we had a home birth, and that were the reasons why I had never actually been admitted to hospital before. So to think of having my baby there, I actually got me a little bit nervous. So yeah. I wanted it to be in our own environment, in the comfort of our home. And yeah, that was a big, played a big role in our decision to have our little girl at home. So yeah, I'm a big advocate for home birth. And if that's what you decide that you want to do.
Absolutely. And that's my approach as well. And I'm all about women birthing where they feel comfortable. And for a lot of women, that is going to be at home.
Yeah.
And the last thing that I hear a lot is that birth has to be this horrible, excruciating experience. I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions that we have just prevalent in our society. Mm-hmm. I've worked with so many women now who absolutely love their birth experience. Many who will say things like, oh, I can't wait to do that again. And they'll often say that it was really intense, but they might not describe it as overly painful. And I think we're so fearful of the pain of birth that we sometimes forget it's something that our bodies are designed to do. Mm-hmm. And we've been doing it for a really long time. And the other thing when we think about pain in birth is that I think a lot of our common maternity practices and environments negatively impact this really delicate hormonal balance that we need for birth.
Yeah.
And particularly our endorphins, so this is our natural painkillers. We know when we have high levels of adrenaline, particularly in early labour, that can both slow down the process of labour but also make it more painful, as it works against that release of the endorphins and also oxytocin, which is another really important hormone in birth. Mm-hmm. So I think the fear of birth, you know, can create this tension and this stress in our body, but also sometimes our birthing environments and some caregivers can not support us and our hormones to work as they're designed to.
I love those topics that you brought up. Thank you. And what are your thoughts around birthing couples creating a birth plan? Are there any important topics or points that you'd recommend they include or leave out, or any sort of tips around that?
I love birth plans. I think they're great. Or we call them birth preferences in the hypnobirthing
Course,
because we can't plan exactly how a birth's going to go, but we can yeah, we can definitely consider all our options and what your preferences would be in certain situations. So I think they're great. At the end of the day, birth preferences are a communication tool, and it allows you to consider what you want for your experience, to make sure that your birth partner and your support people know what you want as well, and then to be able to communicate that with your caregivers. Mm-hmm. So it's not an exact plan of how it's going to go, but it's definitely stating what your preferences are. So one of the things that I think is really important is to tailor them to you, and not to use a generic one or one online. You can get ideas, absolutely, but really make it personal. If there's things that aren't important to you, don't put them in. You know, we do read them as midwives and care providers, and you know, I would much rather a woman have, you know, half a page of some really specific birth preferences than a two-page kind of one that has things that she's not so fussed about.
Yeah,
I think it's also really important to consider different situations. So, for example, if a woman was induced or her baby was born via cesarean, if that was the best way for them to be born, what would they want in that situation? Because the reality is, you're generally not going to have loads of time to consider all of these options when you're in labour. So researching everything before is really important, and just thinking, okay, if I needed a cesarean, if that was the best way for my baby to be born, what kind of things would I want? And what would still make that a positive experience for us? And that's when you can do some research and learn about, you know, different things like delayed cord clamping and immediate skin to skin, and things that might, may or may not be important to you to achieve in that birth experience.
I love that, because things don't always go to plan or you know, the way we vision them to go, and there's always something you can do that is in your control that can make it a better experience. And that's, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because that is my next question was, we know that vaginal birth is superior for inoculating the bubs with the mum's beneficial flora as they move through the birth canal, and therefore building baby's long-term immunity. But in that case of a mum either choosing to have a C-section or requiring an emergency C-section, what can they do or ask or add to that birth preferences in order to best support their baby picking up mum's good bacteria?
So we do know that babies having a different sort of microbiome if they're born via cesarean to a vaginal birth. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we think could be helpful in that is early skin to skin or even immediate skin to skin. So as soon as possible after the baby's born, placing them on your chest, and we put a blanket over them so that, you know, they don't get cold, because litters can be quite cold, but we put them on your chest. That helps for a lot of transitions for their body and in regulating their temperature and things like that. But it also means that they pick up the bacteria that is on your skin.
Yes.
And that is something we can do with a cesarean birth. It's definitely not something that then goes out the window. Breastfeeding as well. We know that when you're breastfeeding, your baby is picking up that bacteria, and particularly with the colostrum that helps to support their gut, you know, in those early days.
And it continues up to, like, you know, 2 years, their immune system is developing. So that's where the breastfeeding's, amazing.
The other thing that's getting a bit more well known is around the vaginal swabbing.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that.
Which is where there's generally gauze placed in the vagina and then wiped over baby after birth. And there's really some promising research in this area. And there's a documentary called Microbirth
that you probably heard of.
And that talks a lot about this. Now, there's sort of, I wouldn't say conflicting evidence, but I think we still need a little bit more evidence in that. I remember one study I was reading a little while ago was talking about how babies who have immediate skin to skin and they're exclusively breastfed for 6 months have that a similar bacteria profile to those who had the vaginal swabbing. So I think there's lots of different ways that we can help to support this. And for some women, you know, the skin to skin is what they want to do. Others, it is the swabbing. Again, it's all a choice, but the reality is that we know that these babies have a different microbiome. So doing what we can to support that, I think, is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And you called it the vaginal swabbing, is that right?
Yeah, it's often called seeding as well.
Yeah, I've heard that term. Yeah. Okay.
It's not something that's quite well not well known in the hospitals, but it is something that women will want to research before, because from a hospital perspective and from me working as a hospital midwife, there's not a lot known about it, I guess, in the hospital system. So women, if they do want that, they really are going to need to ask for it, because it's unlikely to be offered.
Yeah, and chatting about it before birth with their care provider, so they know that that's their wishes beforehand. What about bringing your own towels and clothes for baby? Do you find that that would be something effective, because that's got your own good bacteria on it, not the hospital's?
Yeah, I think that's definitely really beneficial. It's helpful, you know, for other things as well. With babies, but yeah, I think that's definitely something that would be a good option. And even the other thing is skin to skin with dads or birth partners. If for some reason mum, you know, is not feeling well or doesn't want skin to skin at that time, we can still do that with partners, and then babies are going to pick up that bacteria as well.
Perfect. And if mum has to go off to surgery or something like that. Yeah.
And the skin to skin can be commenced again later. So, you know, having it as immediate as possible and uninterrupted until the first breastfeed, if not longer, is beneficial. But we know that women, if they didn't have skin to skin immediately, it's still really beneficial to do it in the hours afterwards or the days afterwards, or even, you know, at home weeks after your baby's born.
Yeah. Wonderful. Now, my husband and I both took the hypnobirthing classes before birth, and I genuinely felt excited about my birth after completing this course. I really did. And so I would love for you to chat about, if for those women who haven't experienced the hypnobirth class or haven't done their research around it, can you give us an introduction and explain the benefits for a birthing couple?
Definitely. So hypnobirthing, there's a few different hypnobirthing courses. So hypnobirthing is a descriptive term. So I'm trained with Hypnobirthing Australia, and our course is really designed to be a childbirth education program which teaches women and their birth partners techniques and a mindset that supports them to have a positive birth experience no matter what turn their birth takes. So we incorporate lots of different teaching from pregnancy and birth experts, along with the hypnotherapy techniques, to provide a comprehensive and up-to-date childbirth education program that's really about promoting positive birth. And it's really about preparing couples to meet whatever turn that their birth takes. The hypnosis part that we use is really about using hypnotherapy techniques to let go and release any fears that we have about birth, and is also used to condition ourselves to release endorphins during labour. And it's all self-hypnosis that we use, so it's not like walking around clucking like a chicken or any swinging watches or things like that that we often think about when we think about hypnosis and what we might have seen on TV and things like that. And there's lots of different techniques that we use. So the self-hypnosis is one of them, but we use lots of breathing and visualization, movement, positioning, lots of techniques that partners can use to help women to achieve a really deep state of relaxation during labour, which allows your body to labour more easily and for the hormones involved in birth to work as they're designed to.
Yeah, absolutely. Very highly recommended. Now, tongue ties, they seem to be more prevalent these days, and I don't know if that's because of better detection or awareness around the topic. And, you know, I believe it could be due to factors switching off on and off certain genes, like nutritional deficiencies and stress playing a role. So I feel that it's something that new mums should really have an awareness around before birth, so then it can be picked up sooner rather than later and avoid impacting things like feeding, attachment and even speech in later years. So can you just briefly chat about what a tongue tie is, the different types if there are, and any tips on detection or treatment recommendations around it?
So tongue ties are quite a hot topic at the moment, even between midwives and lactation consultants and doctors. There's lots of differing views and opinions. There's lots of opinions on whether a tie is or isn't present, whether it should be, there should be a procedure done to release it. Even some women will be told by one lactation consultant that their baby has a tongue tie, but not by another. So it's really hard, I think, for mums with tongue ties at the moment. I'm currently studying to become a lactation consultant, so this isn't quite my area of expertise yet, but it's something that I, as a midwife, work with lots of women that do have babies with a tongue tie, or they're concerned about that. So The tongue tie is often the most common one that we see, where there is generally sort of a piece of skin or a membrane that's restricting the movement of the tongue under the tongue. Yeah. But there's also some other ties, like lip ties and posterior ties and things like that as well. So I think the thing with ties from my approach is that sometimes there are things, there's lots of things that can affect breastfeeding, particularly at the start. And I think if we jump to ties being the issue for every baby, we're going to have quite huge over-treatment rates. Yeah. So my real approach as a midwife is to assess for tongue ties and also to assess if it is affecting feeding or not. Mm-hmm. Because some babies, you know, who have a tie will feed quite well. And like you're saying, there are other long-term things with ties as well. So what I would recommend for women is to be aware that, you know, sometimes tongue ties can be there for their baby or lip ties or different ties, and they may impact breastfeeding or they may not. I think the thing to remember is that most babies don't have a tie that is affecting their breastfeeding or other things. So I think jumping to that as being the first issue with breastfeeding is not ideal. So I think if a mum is concerned about how her baby is latching or breastfeeding, or that she's concerned about a tie, I would recommend that she sees a midwife or a lactation consultant so that we can assess the whole sort of breastfeeding relationship. All babies are checked at birth for tongue ties, and like I said, sometimes they can be really obvious and they can be seen quite easily. Other times they can not be seen, or differences between care providers. So for mums, just reassuring them that, you know, their baby will be checked, you know, at birth or soon afterwards. But sometimes it's a little bit tricky. So being aware if they're having issues, to get in touch with a midwife or a lactation consultant to support that, I think is really helpful, because then they can sort of assess for ties and maybe recommend different options or different courses of actions or things to try.
Excellent. Thank you for that info. Is there anything else that you'd like to chat about to the Glowing Mamas?
I think that's really everything. Yeah. I guess my take-home messages would really be to just prepare as much as you can before your baby's born. If we think mm-hmm. about our wedding day or a marathon, we put mm-hmm. a lot of preparation in place. We research different things. Sure, we don't know that everything's going to go exactly as we planned, but we still put in the work and prepare. And I think that preparation is really, really key. Mm-hmm. Also getting the best support around you from your caregivers and, you know, from your birth team and your partner. And I always say to women, if they're not feeling supported by their caregiver, they can switch. And sometimes this can be a little bit tricky, but that's some of the work that I do with women, is helping them to maybe move to a more supportive care provider if that's what they're feeling is going to be best for them. Mm. And just trusting that your body and baby knows what to do. Birth is a natural process for our body. It's a physiological function. And, you know, most healthy women will birth healthy babies.
That's just incredible information. Thank you so much. Now, please let us know where we can find more about your services.
Mm-hmm. So you can find me in a couple of places. So on Instagram, I'm at Hannah Willsmore Midwife, and Facebook, same, Hannah Willsmore Adelaide Hypnobirthing and Midwife Support, and also my website, hannahwillsmore.com. I post lots of birth stories from couples that have used hypnobirthing, and there's lots of videos on there which I think are really helpful when preparing for birth. And lots of info on postnatal support and things like that as well on there.
I love those videos. I've gone across and yeah. Binged on those. Thank you. That was amazing. Thank you so much, Hannah. I'm sure the Glowing Mamas are going to hugely benefit from your info, and I hope they can find you online for further support. So thanks for joining us today.
That's okay. Thank you for having me.